This programming is sponsored by the Near Northwest Management District. With new commercial construction, more than 350 acres of green space, parks, and sports complex. More information at nnmd.org. Grow near.
Welcome to Party Politics. I'm Brandon Rodinghouse, a political science professor from the University of Houston.
And I'm Jay Iyer, a political science professor from Texas Southern University. Thanks for joining us at our favorite little hangout here where we do our favorite thing every week, talk a little politics. Brandon, we've been talking sort of global affairs lately, and that trend has continued. Massive unrest in the Middle East. What's happening in Israel?
You know, what's interesting is that, you know, President Trump is getting a lot of credit for the things that have happened, some good, some bad, but he was elected really to be kind of a domestic policy president. And here we are talking a lot about foreign policy issues. So that's, I think, pretty interesting. Yeah, like you said, there's some unrest in Jerusalem this week. The president and some of the president's staff have worked to move the embassy to Jerusalem. The unveiling of this did not sit well with many on the Palestinian side. So there's been riots that led to multiple deaths. And it seems to me like, looking at the situation, that peace doesn't seem all that near.
Yeah, so this is part and parcel with kind of a larger policy that the U.S. has had for a while. Since 1995, there was a law that was passed to permanently move the U.S. embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. Every president since, including Bill, from Clinton to George W. Bush, Barack Obama, and then now Trump, previously had signed six-month extensions, kind of allowing it to stay. Trump decided to not do that anymore and instead to move it. It's resulted, as you said, in 50 deaths and over 1,000 injuries. And it's been pretty controversial. I think it's pretty clear there's blame on both sides. The terrorist organization Hamas, that is in charge of the Gaza region of the Palestinian territory, has borne some of the blame by sort of sending folks out there. The Israeli Defense Forces, using live ammunition, has gotten a heavy dose of criticism. Unfortunately, this area is continuing to have problems. We'll see what happens going forward, but it's just another in a long line of tragedies that we've seen there in the region.
Yeah, the relationship has been complicated for years, generations, if you go back far enough, and has always been a powder keg. And the problem is that with a powder keg like this, any small ember is going to create a spark, and that can create an explosion. That's what we saw happen here. I don't know the degree to which the moving of the embassy is something that really advances the U.S. interest. It's clearly a domestic play for the president. But I think in terms of trying to solve the problem long term, this isn't going to get it done.
Yeah, exactly. Well, staying on the international scene, but shifting gears a bit, the president has received a great deal of credit for sort of the detente with North Korea, but it's starting to look a little dicey and a little shaky as to whether that's actually going to happen. President Kim of North Korea has decided to potentially suspend this summit. He canceled bilateral negotiations with South Korea already. And so there's real questions as to whether or not the summit in June is going to be taking place with President Trump in Singapore.
Yeah, this is kind of swinging from one crisis point to another. The goal for the Trump administration was to try to defuse this situation. It looked like maybe they could. In fact, to the point where he made the last week that like the president was being talked about for a Nobel Peace Prize. I find the logic in that a little challenging. Although if the situation is resolved in some way, perhaps there's a long shot, but it seems fairly unlikely. To me, this is the North Koreans' attempt to try to get some leverage in the situation. But I think it's a real risk for the president, right? Right, that if it's the case that they put the president, President Trump, front and center on this and things go badly, then that will reflect badly on President Trump, not the administration writ large or the circumstances, right? Like the president himself. So because the prospects of failure are so high, it could be that if the North Koreans are using this as a kind of ploy or something, then and then eventually kind of pull the rug out from under the administration, or pull like a Lucy with a Charlie Brown, you know, the football situation, then it could make the administration look pretty foolish, right? And really take away one of their signature wins to date.
Yeah, that last analogy you made, that you sort of to peanuts, I think is really what we've had here. North Korea has essentially yanked the football away time and time again. We've actually had very similar positions, both with when George W. Bush was president and when Obama was president. So I think President Trump's put a lot of his personal reputation on the line here, saying that he's going to get a deal done. He's been unusually complimentary of Kim Jong-un recently. So we'll see what happens. I still think the North Koreans, it's in their own interest to come to the table. I don't know if the president is President Trump is going to give up too much to get them there.
Yeah. Well, speaking of deals and deadlines, we have an interesting series of deadlines on NAFTA approaching. Now, the president promised to redo NAFTA, right? One of the worst trade agreements in history, according to him. But it's running up against all kinds of complicated, interconnected rules. Speaker Ryan has insisted that this is the week, this week, to notify Congress of a deal, which has to be done before Congress can legislate a deal. Some of the big holding sticking points here include how the access to markets are going to develop. Some other stumbling blocks include tariffs on steel and aluminum, which the president said he would waive on Canada and Mexico if NAFTA could get done. It's unclear what's going to happen here. I think the president would like to make some progress, but it doesn't seem likely given where things are in the legislative process.
Yeah, I think that's correct. The issues are really complicated in large part because NAFTA itself is a 20-year-old agreement. So updating the agreement makes perfect sense. The president, who ran on the idea of wanting to bring manufacturing back into the U.S., is really insisting that there's some tweaking to the language that's going to essentially foster more economic development, more manufacturing in the U.S. rather than a lower wage country like Mexico. So part of the issue ends up being that's a core principle of the original NAFTA agreement, right? Where there's labor advantages, you're going to take labor advantages. Where there's other advantages, the country was going to have it, but you would have free and open markets. I'm not sure if they're going to get there. We also have visa issues related to this, right? Because you have free movement of labor, certainly between the three countries to varying degrees through a NAFTA-style visa. That actually could be a larger prong that they could use to maybe solve some of the issues with the undocumented, at least coming from Mexico. There's a lot of moving pieces here, and Mexico has a presidential election just around the corner, and the incumbent party in power is very likely to lose. And so a lot of these negotiations may be for naught.
Right. And the person who's likely to win is going to be much more kind of progressive. And so I don't know that they're willing to bend on some of these issues. There's some hope from the administration they can get what they've called like a skinny bill, an auto-only bill. One of the sticking points is the question about what they call the rules of origin, which governs how much of a car can be sourced from NAFTA countries to qualify for the reduced duties under the agreement. There's also some concern from the U.S. that basically these other countries, especially Mexico, are paying people too low. So they've tried to inject into that the need and requirement that the certain parts be worked on by people earning more than $15 an hour. So that gets at the president's kind of populist message. My sense here is that not much will happen in the current phase because we're already close to the point where they couldn't negotiate through the kind of lame duck congressional phase. But I do think that the president ultimately could get some kind of deal here. And for him, that's going to be a win, right? Saying, you know, I renegotiated NAFTA, which is technically true, is probably a good reason that people are going to look at him and sort of express some empathy and say that he did a good job.
Well, we know politics has been driving that process. That's a big part of why the president's been pushing it. We had a big sort of day or last few days in politics nationally, a lot of primaries and key battleground states, important states like West Virginia, Pennsylvania, Ohio, earlier than that. What's going on nationally and what did we learn from it?
Some interesting dimensions, Jay. There's a lot going on, so we'll just kind of take one slice of it. But one thing I thought that was really interesting, I'll say two things. One is that in Pennsylvania in particular, which is really going to be, I think, a pretty big swing state, not just for 18, but also for 20, you saw the suburbs, I think, trending towards the Democrats. That's a big change and also something that's going to be potentially profitable for the candidates in 18. You also saw a lot, again, of more women running and winning. And that, too, I think, has the promise to help the Democrats. But I want to pivot to a state where I used to live, and that's Idaho, Jay. At the start, we don't talk about much. Nobody ever taps me for my Idaho politics experience.
Idaho had a big change, potentially on the Democratic side. They could have the first Native American governor.
Yeah.
But on the Republican side, you know, incumbency does not always benefit you. And that's a good sort of example of conservative politics coming up against Trump politics. And in this case, Trump politics won, right, Brandon?
Yeah, it's interesting. We have also, Raul Labrador, who had run for governor as a member of the House, was the fourth Republican to lose from the House member seeking higher office. So being in the House is not like a stepping stone, maybe the way that it used to be. But I think you're right. Like I said, Idaho is really interesting, and we tend to kind of ignore it because it's sort of a small state. It's out of the way. And we also presume it's a Republican state, and it is, but the demographics in Idaho are changing. changing, just like they are in Texas. You've got more people moving in. You've got an expansion of younger people who are moving to big urban areas. So Paulette Jordan, who is a two-term lawmaker, could become the first Native American governor. And I think that's really interesting. She's winning among independents and she's rallying Democrats. So although I don't think that she'll win, it's still a clearly red state. The fact that it's changing suggests that maybe there is something afoot in terms of, you know, the Democrats being able to do better.
And that's an interesting one to me, because the lieutenant governor who won the Republican nomination was a strong and solid early supporter of Donald Trump. Mm-hmm. And so this could be an interesting question of whether or not a kind of centrist Democrat versus a Trump Republican in a Western state with, again, Idaho also has a large, Mormon population, which we know had voted heavily against Trump,
yep.
Whether that plays a role in it. And as you said, Idaho is changing. So it could be an interesting kind of bellwether for Western states. Speaking of bellwethers in terms of states, we've also seen like Pennsylvania had a significant change. I thought, at least what caught my eye, was the notion of, for a long time, we thought that Democrats have essentially subverted their notion of always going to a more progressive candidate and decided to make electability the big issue.
Yeah.
Well, lo and behold, in some of these contested primaries, the more progressive candidate beat back a more mainstream, more in some cases conservative Democratic challenger, mm-hmm. or a Democratic incumbent in some cases. So again, party primaries are what they always will. They tend to favor the extremes of both parties.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. And we're definitely likely to see this continue because we're only halfway through the primary season. Speaking of the primary season, we've got early voting in Texas, which has started. Listeners, if you haven't gone to vote yet, please go vote. There's lots of cool stuff on the ballot. As it is so far, not many people have voted. We're only about 2% right now. If we get to 6%, I'd be pretty surprised, although we might get within sniffing range of that. At this point, it looks like Democrats are outnumbering Republicans in terms of total votes, but that's only an aggregate. Some places like Tarrant County have got more Republicans and Democrats voting. So it's a mixed bag, and of course depends on, you know, where you live, because some runoffs are more competitive than others. Some are more Republican, some are more Democratic, so it just depends.
Yeah, I think statewide you have more contested Democratic runoffs right now, and I think that's driving some of it. We know that the congressional races are driving these statewide numbers. Here in Harris County, we've got two big races, one on the Democratic side, one on the Republican side, that tends to drive the vote up. I'm curious what you think the total vote's going to be in terms of this early vote, and in just in general, this runoff cycle, Brandon.
Yeah.
Do you see it approaching anywhere near what we had the first go around?
I mean, I don't think it'll get quite that close, but I think we are seeing the enthusiasm continue. So I think for Democrats, then this is encouraging news, right? They want to see people coming to vote. And although it's been contested, I think it is the case that that's spurring people to come and vote. The question is, will it last? And if it's the case that this breeds a certain degree of disunity, can it backfire on the party? I think it could. So how you kind of mend those fences after the primary is going to be really important.
Yeah, and where those contested races are, I think, is key.
Yeah.
And it has a real, I think, effect. It's potentially going to have a real effect on the governor's race, yeah, on the Democratic side, because, you know, how you're doing in those races, that's where 3/4 of the votes coming out of,
yeah,
is going to determine who ends up being the Democratic nominee for governor to run against Greg Abbott.
I think both of the gubernatorial candidates are kind of treading water. I mean, you know, I think we're going to see a closer than expected race. The debate, which we talked about a lot last week, showed that, you know, there's definitely some reasons for both wings of the party to have somebody they could support. Ultimately, I think Valdez will win, but I don't know that she created a situation where it was an obvious slam dunk, and I don't know that either one of them are really prepared at this point to take on Greg Abbott in a significant way. But if they're closer to the top of the ticket, they're helping every other candidate down ballot and to some degree above them with the O'Rourke race, O'Rourke and Cruz race, to be able to generate enthusiasm.
Well, Brandon, Texas is back in court again. Ken Paxton is filing a couple of interesting lawsuits. First and foremost, you talked about this on the radio not just the other day. What's going on voter fraud?
Yeah, so this is a long continuing saga of Republicans versus vote fraud. Ken Paxton announced he is going to prosecute a Mexican national who's accused of voter fraud here in Harris County after stealing the identity of a U.S. citizen. This individual had been indicted in Montgomery County by a grand jury, but had and had voted in a couple of elections since then. And this is obviously something that is a political ploy. It's a political outcome for Greg Abbott, but also, of course, there's a criminal element to this, which the Attorney General is using as a way to be able to talk tough on this issue. To me, this is like the merging of the two most critical issues for Republicans. It's illegal immigration and vote fraud. It's like peanut butter and jelly.
Yeah, GOP catnip right yeah. there, isn't it? Pretty
or like
much?
Brisket and pickles. Right? They go together perfectly. So it's a winnable issue for them. In terms of total like number of issues and times in which there's vote fraud, it doesn't happen that often. There have been some spikes in places like Fort Worth and in South Texas, but overall, it's not a major problem. I don't know that this rises to the level of the Attorney General getting involved, but it's obvious that this is a political issue.
Well, what's not brisket and pickles is often Ken Paxton suing for consumer protection.
Yeah.
And he has joined six other states to file a suit against Big Pharma and in particular the folks who put out OxyContin and other opioids that has been a scourge on the country. It's kind of an interesting lawsuit in general because it's one of the rare times that the state is essentially looking to recover dollars from the settlements, potential settlements, to fund treatment programs and to fund the overall cost to society.
Yeah.
It's not unlike what we saw with big tobacco.
Yeah, I was going to say, yeah.
Yeah, it's very similar to that. So it'll be interesting to see as this moves forward. But I think just politically for Ken Paxton, it's an interesting take to sort of buttress all of his traditional kinds of lawsuits with this big, large, multi-state effort. Yeah. On consumer protection.
Is this just leverage? I mean, the states are negotiating with these manufacturers to be able to, as you say, get some relief money. Is this just one way to put extra pressure on these companies, or is this like a legitimate, you know, kind of Hail Mary, like, let's see if we can get like them to commit to this in court?
I think it's both. It's, you know, it's one of those things that sometimes may drive a settlement because we know that's likely the outcome here.
Yeah.
And just to fund some of the treatment programs. But yeah, you've got to file the lawsuit, show you're serious.
Okay.
Well, speaking of settlements, our favorite former Congress member, Blake Farenthold, has a new gig. What's he doing, Brandon?
Yeah, so this is Representative Blake Farenthold, who has decided to not run for re-election. There were for months and months speculation about him paying back funds from a taxpayer account that was used to settle sexual harassment claims that came out of his office. Well, now he's got a pretty lucrative new gig lobbying for the port of Port Lavaca and Point Comfort. This is a pretty big salary, $160,000. This definitely lets him land on his feet. And Jay, who better to land on their feet than a disgraced member of Congress?
Indeed, right? Indeed. The swamp lives on. The swamp lives on. Well, let's take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk about the big story of the week, the bombshell out of the Supreme Court that's going to shape everything here in Texas and everywhere else. And that's sports betting is on. Are you ready to start betting on everything?
So, Jay, the Supreme Court this week essentially suggested that laws that Congress had written that said that only certain states can allow for sports betting were illegal, unconstitutional. This potentially opens up the avenue for other states to expand gaming. Will Texas follow suit? What do you think?
Yeah, you know, it's an interesting case. It came out of a lawsuit that was filed by the governor of New Jersey that essentially said that states should have the ability to gamble on sports if they choose to do so. They already have statewide, we know there's statewide lotteries and those other entities, and that it wasn't a direct violation of the Interstate Commerce Clause, which is what they were using to essentially say it was illegal. States have already lined up, not surprisingly, states that already do allow some form of gambling, Mississippi, Louisiana, New Jersey themselves are named in it. I think Delaware has also stepped up and said they're going to do it. Those are probably the first states. The question here in Texas, I think, is about politics.
Yeah.
We know that the NBA and the NFL and Major League Baseball are, I think, interested in cashing in on some of this.
Mm-hmm.
So the question is just, will the politics of Texas allow it? Will we allow it? Because it's still it's ruled state by state. And that kind of shifts gears to what we think will happen in the legislature. We know a bill is going to get filed. What are your thoughts? I don't know that the governor or lieutenant governor have a firm position on it.
You know, the lieutenant governor has been pretty firmly against it when the Texas Gaming Commission tried to expand historical racing, which is basically where they take kind of like pictures, TV footage of old races and strip all the information off it so you don't know who it was and what race it was and run them again, essentially, and allow you to bet on them. The lieutenant governor was against the expansion of that at the time, partly because it was the Gaming Commission had kind of usurped legislative authority. But there's a moral component to this, too, that he has sort of implied and that many have suggested. And I think that this makes for a bunch of conflicted conservatives. That is, they like the idea of the revenue. And we were talking about billions of dollars in trade. A lot of people look at this process and say, like, we're losing money to Texans who go to Oklahoma or go to Louisiana to gamble, and basically the money leaves the state and doesn't come back. Well, that money could stay here and fund something like public education, which needs a lot of money to kind of make things right. So I think conservatives are conflicted between needing to have and liking that revenue and the kind of moral underpinnings of this. There's also a financial argument, too. I mean, some of the conservatives have said that there's a multiplier of the amount of money that's raised in gambling for the kind of money that would be needed to, like, to resolve criminal issues that relate to that, right? So every dollar, one study suggested every dollar you generate in gambling, you create three more dollars of cost because you have to have expanded criminal enforcement measures. So I think conservatives sort of like the idea of it, but like every other kind of fairy tale, there's parts of it that you like, and there's also a sense that it's never going to really happen.
I think what you can do is sort of bifurcate this, because there's gambling generally, which I think there is a built-in structure in place to sort of morally oppose it. But I also think sports gambling is a little bit different.
Yeah.
Because as we know, this is Texas, football is king, and folks like it. They like the point spreads, and there's a whole lot of gambling that already occurs in by many conservative people as it relates to sports.
Yeah.
And I think that there'd be a much bigger appetite for allowing folks in Texas to be able to go ahead and gamble or bet on sporting games and distinguish that from, say, full-blown casino gambling. And so I think you might be surprised to see some interesting coalitions develop, particularly since some of the folks now that are most in favor of this tend to be sports teams.
Yeah.
It'll be interesting to see if Jerry Jones and Tillman Fertitta and Bob McNair and others who get involved in this, Mark Cuban, who see this as a potential revenue source for themselves, but also for the state of Texas, if they start exerting pressure to get in on it, we might see, I think, some movement. And it wouldn't surprise me, maybe not immediately this subsequent session.
Yeah.
But as we know, things tend to take a couple sessions to develop. I kind of think it might happen.
Interesting. I mean, I think you're right in that the unfolding of gaming has gone slowly, right? We have the lottery, then you know, you've got the expansion of raffles. You also have an expansion of horse racing and gambling on that. So there have been moments where this does sort of proceed slowly. I suspect that if it did happen, it would come in a very sluggish manner, in part because of the structure that would have to allow it to happen. You would need to have 2/3 of the legislature approve, and then that would have to go to the voters, which would require majority support. At one of those stages, you're likely to find some trip-ups. I suspect it's more in the legislative than the public, because I think you're right, people want to see this happen, at least many people do. So I do think if it happens, it would happen very slowly.
Well, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to tell you why betting in Texas matters to you.
So, Jay, the Supreme Court's ruling this week has opened up this question about whether or not Texas may legalize gambling. Why should people care about this? What's your take on what's going to happen?
Simple reason is just revenue. The state of Texas needs more dollars. We don't want to tax ourselves. We don't want a statewide income tax. We don't want a statewide property tax. And we don't want to expand sales tax the way it currently is. This is probably the most meaningful way to generate revenue in the least painful way possible. Mm. So I think ultimately it's going to find its time here in Texas. And I think the public will support it.
You know, my take on it, at least in the short term, is that we shouldn't bet on it. All pun intended, right? It would take a political earthquake like the Great Depression to expand gaming in Texas. There are so many forces opposed to it in the legislature. The last time it was like expanded in a significant way was after the Great Depression, where Texas legalized pari-mutuel betting. Eventually, they did away with it, though, right? The very conservative governor, James Allred, ended up doing away with it. Every year, there are bills filed to expand gaming. In this last session, Representative Gutierrez filed a bill to have a constitutional amendment to allow for 12 casinos to operate in the state and have those auctioned off. it never went anywhere and almost never does. I just can't see that you would find the current crop of Republicans supporting this enough. But at some point, like you say, the revenue will be very tempting and we're likely to see some movement in that direction.
Well, that's it for this week. Party Politics is recorded in the George B. Geary Performance Studio at Houston Public Media.
Thanks to our executive producer, Don Geraci, who knows when to hold them and when to fold them, to our web team, Giselle Bueno and Matt Prendergast, and to our graphics guru, Michelle Lamb. And finally, thanks to our audio engineer, Todd, the gambling man, Holslander.
I'm Jay Iyer.
And I'm Brandon Rodinghouse. We'll see you next week.